Now it gives me pleasure to call upon Brother Don Jameson to deal with the subject taken from chapter 9, the adversary from within and Ezra's prayer.
My beloved brothers and sisters, first verse of our chapter 9, now when these things were done. So we ask the question, what things, and we remind ourselves that Ezra had proclaimed a fast, the gold and silver vessels are delivered safely into the hands of the priests, having been brought safely to Jerusalem, and burnt offerings have been offered. Can we then enter into the heart and the mind of Ezra at this particular time? Lifted out of Babylon. Lifted up now. Giving praise and glory and honour to the Father for all the blessings that have come upon him and his people. The pride of the flesh has been put down now. Here now they're extolling and worshipping the great God of heaven, the one who has delivered them. And now they are to worship Yahweh according to the law, and they are to rejoice together as his holy people. So Ezra then is full of joy, full of anticipation. And now, the enormity of the situation, brethren and sisters, we must try to enter into the reflex, as it were, now, as we read the following verses. It tells us there, verse 1, just let's follow it through. Ezra, elevated in heart and mind, full of joy, and now, the princes, those who are in high authority in Judah, they come. The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, doing according to their abominations, even to that of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. Now think, brothers and sisters, of the impact of those words now upon Ezra. Let's really see what it meant to him. Let us go back to the 2nd of Kings and just reflect upon what is written there. 2nd of Kings chapter 21 and verses 1 and 2. Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and reigned 55 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hephzibah. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh, after the abominations of the heathen, whom Yahweh cast out before the children of Israel. And what did he do? He built up again the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed. He reared up the altars for Baal. He made a grove, as did Ahab, king of Israel, and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. And so it goes on. What a dreadful catalogue is there, brethren and sisters. Now, just reading that, we might not have any idea of what it really means. But recent archaeology has brought to our notice now some of the abominations which were then committed. Let me just read a few lines about these matters. There it's telling us, amongst many other things, there we are, yes. What is accepted as a matter of course that every half-civilized community controls the morality of its citizens? But in the days of Canaan, in those days, the cult of sensuality was regarded as the worship of the gods. It's necessary, I feel, that our young people even might grasp some of these matters. Let them emphasize themselves upon our hearts and minds. And what is it saying? In Canaan in those days, the cult of sensuality was regarded as the worship of the gods. We've just seen what Manasseh has done. Temples took the place of brothels. Men and women prostitutes were regarded as sacred to the followers of the religion. And the rewards of their services went into the temple treasuries as offerings for the god. No, brethren and sisters, I'll not read any more. It's dreadful reading. But that precisely is what happened, and that is what Manasseh reinstituted, just one example, into so-called the worship of Israel. Can we understand then what that really means? Let's take another example. Let's go back to the 1st of Kings in the 11th chapter now. 1st of Kings and the 11th chapter and verse 5. And here, brethren and sisters, if we're not impressed by these things, just let's see what really happened. And the 11th of the 1st of Kings, and we look at verse 5. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abominations of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of Yahweh, and went not fully after Yahweh as did David his father. Then, verse 7, did Solomon build a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill country that is before Jerusalem. And so it goes on. And there his strange wives moved him to do these things. This man, brethren and sisters, who asked for wisdom, this man who gave such a beautiful prayer at the dedication of the temple. You read it. How beautiful it was. And now, what is he doing? As we just read there, brethren and sisters, in that book, that is what he was doing. And that is what he was counseling there from his wives in the midst of the nation of Israel. Just one further illustration, the 2nd of Kings now, and verse 23. 2nd of Kings, chapter 23, and verse 13. And the high places that were before Jerusalem. What were the high places? The high places, brethren and sisters, were those which formed the sensuality. There was the brothel. That's what it became. And so it reads, and the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had builded for Ashtaroth, the abomination of the Zidonians, and for Chemosh, and so it goes on. And there is the chapter where Josiah, a faithful man of God, broke them all down. But immediately Josiah was dead, the people went back again to this dreadful worship. And so as Israel followed these examples, even offering their own children, think of that. They were offering even their own children in sacrifice to these gods of wood and stone, and they were allowing them to be burnt in the fire, and so on. Can you imagine then the state of heart and mind now of this faithful, upright scribe and leader of his people when these things are brought to his notice? That is what we want to impress our minds with, brethren and sisters. And you read on there in verse 2 of our chapter, chapter 9. For they have taken of their daughters for themselves, and their sons, and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and the rulers hath been chief in this trespass. So Ezra, elevated in heart and mind at the goodness of Yahweh. And now this report of the things which are happening. Then those people who have been delivered out of Egypt, out of Babylon rather. I want you to try to enter into his heart and mind. The Holy Seed. It was in Israel, brethren and sisters. And through them, through the Holy Seed, would come, and I'm sure our young people understand this, they would understand Genesis 3:15. The seed of the woman. They would understand that out of the seed of the woman now was to come the Christ, the great deliverer. And later, it was centered in the Abrahamic covenant. And later, it was centered in Abraham's seed, as you know, Paul explains to us, in Abraham and in his seed. And then again, as you think about it, through Abraham's grandson, Jacob, he had 12 sons. Through which of the tribes then was the Holy Seed to be found? All this, you see, flooded into Ezra's mind now, as he reflected upon these things. So we have to think then deeply now, why was Ezra so concerned? Well, the wickedness of the people was bad enough. That was dreadful. And what now? So that the Holy Seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the rulers and the chief priests, they're following their example. Can you think then of what happened now to Ezra in his state of heart and mind? Look what follows. When I heard this thing, I rent my garment. And so it goes on. But before we do that, brothers and sisters, let's just develop for a moment now just what this really means about the seed. It came out of Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman to destroy the serpent's seed. It came through history, through Abraham. Abraham, separate yourself from the apostasy around, come into a land, I will give it to you forever. The covenant is made there regarding the seed. And the promise is concerning his seed. The eternal possession of that land of Canaan. Through the Christ, as we know. But now, as we said, Jacob had 12 sons. Into which family now? Let's go to Genesis 49. And there, in the beautiful prophetic blessings which are uttered now upon the 12 tribes, so we learn as we come to the 8th verse of Genesis 49, Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. And so it goes on. Judah's a lion's whelp, verse 9. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, verse 10. Here is the royal tribe then, brethren and sisters, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh shall come. And to him shall the gathering of the people be. And then, those beautiful terms which follow, we have the sacrificial aspect now of the Christ. Not for us to consider at the moment, but there it is. And so, Judah then. It was through the line of Judah now. Now then, it followed again, as we've already heard today, through the 2nd of Samuel chapter 7, through the line of David now. But the question still remained in Israel. And I want us to appreciate this, brethren and sisters, because all faithful wives in Judah were ambitious to become, obviously, the mother of the seed of the woman. What a great honour would be bestowed upon such an one. And thus then we have the incentives for faith and purity to follow closely the laws of Yahweh. Now this was Ezra's great concern now. Can we understand? Can we sympathize with him now? The mingling now of the holy seed with the inhabitants of Canaan. And they were steeped in grossness and immorality. They were worse than the animals, brethren. It is an insult to compare them to animals, brethren and sisters. It's no wonder that the Father in his wisdom told Israel, destroy them, man, woman and child. Only evil would come from them, as history has proved, brethren and sisters. And so, as we think about it now, it was not the poor, humble ones in Israel at that time, in Judah rather at that time, but it was those who were prominent now, prominent in the rulership of Judah, and they caused this dreadful departure from the law. And that, brethren and sisters, as we think about it now, causes Ezra to be astonished. Just come to that third verse now, in the light of what we've just read. And when I heard this thing, I rent my garments and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and my beard and sat down astonished. Now that word, if we think about it now, it means to stun, to grow numb, to be devastated. Psalm 143 verse 4 tells us, therefore is my spirit overwhelmed within me, my heart within me is desolate. Now that is the same word as astonished there. And so we note that the effect of this information now had upon the heart and mind of this faithful man of God. Now what we want to notice is this. There was no raving. There was no raving, brethren and sisters. There was no show of great anger. No. In fact, no words were uttered. No words were uttered to reveal his state of heart and mind. No, he plucked off his hair and so on. He showed his terrible displeasure there, and he sat there quietly to assess the situation and to think about what was to be done. What an example to us, brethren and sisters. Those who have problems to handle in the ecclesia, well, there is the example now. Let's just sit down quietly. Let the full impact of all what the problem is, let it hit us. And then, brethren and sisters, let us act. What an example to us then. And so you can see, you can enter into the mind of Ezra. There he would be laying this matter before the Father. Of course he would. But let's read on. We come to the fourth verse of this ninth chapter. Then were assembled unto him everyone that trembled at the words of the Elohim of Israel because of the transgressions of those that had been carried away. And I sat astonished. I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice. Now, until the evening sacrifice. There was, as you know, the evening and the morning sacrifice of the Lamb all down through Israel's history, continually reminding the people of sin, their sin, and the way of acceptance through the shedding of the blood of the Lamb, through the way of acceptance. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. All pointing forward to the Lamb. The Lamb. One thinks of Abraham. You remember journeying there with Isaac? You think of the detail. Let it flood into your minds. And so the Lamb then. The most innocent and the unoffensive of all God's creatures. There is blood now Christ's throat is cut and the blood flows out, that life ebbs away all because of sin. And so the awfulness of sin then, brethren and sisters, and rebellion and departure from right ways comes into our mind. And this is what hit Ezra now. Now our young people, and we have, our brother has spoken to them before of these matters today. Let them learn these things. We feel for you. You're going into a world, young people, that is full of Canaanites and Canaanite immorality. But here before you, as you have been exhorted today, is the answer. This is the only answer to these matters. And so the Lamb then, when this is realized, the heart is softened. And we're talking about Ezra's situation now as he pondered upon the Lamb and the evening sacrifice. His heart was softened now. And the realization comes that only the Father can help. Only the Father can help and forgive. And we must fall into his merciful hands. And this is precisely what Ezra did. Let's look, verse 5. And at the evening sacrifice I arose up from my heaviness, having rent my garment and my mantle, and I fell upon my knees and spread out my hands unto Yahweh mine Elohim. And I said, and here now is that which has been formulated into the mind now of this faithful priest in Israel. The realization of the propensities of our nature overwhelmed him. Brethren, sisters, this is what we have to learn in the truth. We have to learn this, and it's a hard way to learn it. But Ezra had done so, and we note then, as we follow down in this beautiful prayer, that Ezra does not exclude himself from the sin of his people. No. He realizes, as we all have to realize, that the temptation to sin was also in him and it's also in us. Paul says, you remember, for all have sinned, and come short of the glory of God. And so as we think then of Ezra's beautiful prayer here, let's just think of that one of Daniel. Daniel, situation perhaps a little more different, but let's go back and notice some of the facts there in the prayer of Daniel in chapter 9. Daniel chapter 9 and verse 3. There he'd been reading the prophet Jeremiah. There he realized that the ending now of the 70 years captivity was upon him. And so he says, verse 3, I set my face unto Yahweh, Adonai Yahweh, to seek by prayer and supplications, with fasting and sackcloth and ashes, and I prayed unto Yahweh mine Elohim, and made my confession and said, O Adonai, the great and dreadful ail, keeping the covenant and the mercy to them that love him, and to them that keep his commandments. We have sinned. Does not exclude himself from the sin of the people that brought about their captivity. We have committed iniquity. We have done wickedly. We have departed even by, we have rebelled by departing from thy precepts and from thy judgments. And so he goes on in that beautiful prayer, brethren and sisters, pleading with the Father now for his people. And you notice there is an expression in that prayer, confusion of face. Confusion of face. It's found, going back to our chapter, in verse 7. Ezra chapter 9, verse 7. And there it is, in the last lines. There he says, we have been delivered into the hand of the kings of the land, to the sword, to captivity, to a spoil, and to confusion of face, as it is this day. It is a feeling of shame and of the condition as it wells up within him. The cause and the effect, the realization of this. This is what entered into the heart and mind of Ezra now. When we go back to the Psalm of David, there we have his experiences shown to us. Just let's go back to Psalm 35, just to open up this matter a little bit further. Psalm 35, and there we are introduced to David. There in verse 3, draw out also the spear and stop the way against them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. And here David in this psalm is praying for his own safety. As the headings say, he is pleading with the Father for his enemy's confusion. And as you read down that chapter now, we realise that it's also applicable to our Lord and Master, because it is a messianic psalm. Verse 7, for without cause they have hid from me their net in a pit, which without cause they have digged for my soul. And verse 26, let them be ashamed and brought to confusion together that rejoice at my heart hurt. Let them be clothed with shame that dishonour, that magnify themselves against me. And all this, brethren and sisters, our Master had to face, David had to face it, and here Ezra realised too that these troubles were in their midst. And so we come now to the 8th verse of this 9th chapter, and now, for a little space, he says, grace has been showed from Yahweh our Elohim to leave us a remnant to escape, and to give us a nail in his holy place, that our God may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. For a little space. Examining that word, brethren and sisters, it means a moment. It means the wink of an eye. As quickly as that. The wink of an eye. The movement of an eyelid. Come with me to Isaiah 54. Isaiah 54 and verse 7. Isaiah 54 verse 7. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment. There it is. But with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, as saith Yahweh thy Redeemer. It's the matter of the barren Israel, the barren nation. And she's going to be caused to sing, as verse 1 tells you. Sing, O thou barren that didst not bear. Break forth into singing. It is something which she has to yet experience. And again, the 26th of Isaiah, 26th of Isaiah, and there in verse 20. Oh, what a beautiful setting we have here, brethren and sisters. Surely our young people can understand this. 19, the verse 19. There the matters of the resurrection. Thy dead shall live. My dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust. For thy dew is the dew of herbs, and so on. There's the wonderful event which is before our eyes, brethren and sisters, the resurrection of the dead. And then what? As the judgments of the Father come upon the world of the Canaanites, let's put it right, look what happens. Verse 20, come, my people. Come, my people, enter into thy chambers, shut thy doors about thee, hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment. There it is, the winking of an eye. For until the indignation be overpassed. For, behold, Yahweh cometh out of his place to punish. And brethren and sisters, those who in that glorious and wonderful day are the subjects of that resurrection and become the Spirit's due, time doesn't matter to them anymore. Time doesn't matter to them. And therefore, come, my people, enter into thy chambers, hide thyself for a little while until the judgments be overpast. What a comfort and a joy, brothers and sisters. And when we think what is to come upon this dreadful, wicked world by which we are surrounded. And so our moment of time then. And Ezra is saying there in that, going back to our 8th verse there of the 9th chapter, he's saying, in effect, he says, grace and mercy has been shown to us of the Father. He's been gracious unto us. He showed from Yahweh our Elohim to leave us a remnant now. Here's the remnant now. Here they are returned in the land. And he says, and to give us a nail. To give us a nail in his holy place, that our Elohim might lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. Now what did he mean? He's speaking there of the grace and mercy. He's speaking of a remnant who have escaped from Babylon and now in their land, and the Father has given us a nail, he says. The promise of a deliverer, that our mighty one may please, can I have your attention? That the mighty one now might give us a nail. And what is that nail, brethren and sisters? The promise of a deliverer to lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. Now, we've already referred to this. Let's go back again to Isaiah chapter 22. And there, as we indicated earlier, it's the prophecy now concerning two men, Shebna and Eliakim. Eliakim, Yah will set up. And so, coming to Isaiah chapter 22 now, and verse 20, remind ourselves again, and it shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim. Now there, as we said, we're introduced now to the Lord Jesus Christ, our Lord and Master, the one who has the key. And so on. Eliakim shall set up. And then we come, as we follow it down now, verse 23. Jesus now, or Yahshua as the nail, is fastened in Jerusalem. And there, brethren and sisters, it's telling us that the only safe place in this world, in the eyes of his children, the Father's children, is Jerusalem. Not at the moment, but the Father's purposes all centre there, and the nail is to be fastened there, and there is going to be established, as you see in verse 23, a glorious throne of his Father's house, and they shall hang upon him all the glory of his Father's house. The offspring and the issue, all vessels of small quantity and so on. And in that day, ah yes. But let's picture it in our minds first of all, brethren and sisters. I don't want to go on any further in that chapter. But there we have the use of the nail. Now, the nail, just quoting from Ezekiel 15, you needn't turn to it. There, shall wood be taken thereof to do any work? Or will men take a pin of it to hang any vessel thereon? Immediately we understand the nail, the vessels hanging upon that nail in the sure place. Just think about that again now, because nails or pins were used in the tabernacle. They were associated with the matters of separation. They were used in the construction of the court of the tabernacle, which separated the main compartment of the tabernacle, the holy place and the most holy place, from the camp of Israel. Separation. And thinking of separation then, when we come back to Ezra chapter 9 and verse 12. There. Now therefore give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their wealth forever, that ye may be strong and eat the good of the land, and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. Now there, brethren and sisters, is exhortation indeed. We who are parents or grandparents, there it's saying, don't let us give our sons and our daughters to those outside. Keep them within the hope of Israel. And we're not to seek the peace which the nations desire, because that is not peace, and we're not to seek their wealth either. That ye may be strong. That ye may be strong. How careful we must be then, brethren and sisters, as we have to live. How wise we have to be as we're living in a Canaanitish society. Can't put it plainer than that, but it's true, absolutely true. And if we love our children, then we shall act wisely. We shall seek to educate them in the hope of Israel. And not only that, brethren and sisters, but we shall explain to them what separation means. That we must not allow the world and its evils to come into our dwellings. We must not do this. Just go back to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 3. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughters thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son, for they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. And so will the anger of Yahweh be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly. And there it is. How wise we must be then as we try to guide our children in the way which is right. We must explain to them, brethren and sisters, all that we understand regarding these matters. And so we reflect then. Have we, as the Israel of Yahweh in these last days, mingled ourselves with the people of the land? Have we? Indeed we have. Indeed we have. We have openly taken, or some at least advocate, to take them into our bosoms. They are as good as us. They are worshippers of God. They do a lot of good. And sometimes they do put us to shame. Well, think about it. But as the word tells us, brethren and sisters, it is the hope of Israel which separates. The hope of Israel separates. And plainly, those who seek the world are ignorant of the word. They are. And much of our troubles, as has been said by our brethren today, is through ignorance. Ignorance of the word. And so, ignorance then, and the excuses of the flesh, there they are. And so we have, as you follow it down, we have this dreadful laxity of reading, of absorbing the words of Yahweh into our hearts and into our minds. But it is also in small things that we have departed. And once we begin to depart, brethren and sisters, the pace gets very, very quick. Like the Canaanites around us, we have even borrowed their style and their method of approach to the throne of grace. Like them, we have begun to familiarize ourselves in our prayers to the Almighty. We don't realize what we're doing. 70 years and 10. Dust and ashes. Clay, that's all we are. And we're addressing the one whom no flesh can approach unto. We're not worthy. He cannot look upon sin. He is the great creator and sustainer of worlds seen and unseen. Let us try to understand our own littleness and something of his greatness. And we address him in terms of you. How dare we, brethren and sisters? How dare we? And that's not all, is it? In our dress, we dress like the Canaanites. We follow their example. And we reveal in ourselves the spirit of the age, which soon is going to be destroyed. How dare we? Many excuses are made, I know. But, brethren and sisters, we have, when the truth works in us, we have a deportment, and it develops character. And when we approach the Father in any way, then we're going to be on our best in every way, surely. And not only that, brethren and sisters, I plead with you. Our brother Round this morning beautifully developed for us the matter of the building and then the scaffolding. Well, it's perfectly true. Absolutely true. There is a scaffolding. Let me try to get you thinking. As I look in the ALS diary and note there the professional approach and the organisation which has developed to do the Father's work for him, when I look at that, brethren and sisters, I tremble. I tremble. Why? When I reflect upon the fact that all that the saints were asked to do, as you go to Acts chapters 2, 3, 4 and so on, there you will find that all they were asked to do was to gather themselves together, to exhort one another, to keep the memorials, to remember together the work of the Lamb in his absence, to care for one another in love, to keep themselves from the world, and to love the Word, that the Word may be present in them. Now, as history tells us, because of the faith and trust and obedience, and because the world hates truth, as you think of the matters of history, those early 3 centuries particularly, there you will find that the ecclesia developed into the church, and the faithful ones in the ecclesia became the woman in the wilderness, hated by their brethren, the remnant of the woman's seed. And the scriptures are silent. They are absolutely silent regarding any ecclesial organization in the last days. The Laodicean state, that's what we're living in. The Laodicean state. From AD 312 to the coming of the Master. And there's nothing, brethren and sisters, in the Word. What I'm trying to do is to ask you to enlarge your minds, to see the scaffolding, and that scaffolding shortly is to be taken away. And then what? Those who, like Ezra, have loved the Word and have been full of anguish of heart and mind about the things that go on around us, such brethren and sisters in their prayers and pleadings to the Father will surely be found amongst that great company of the redeemed. One could go on. There are many troubles which possess us as Christadelphians in these last days. What are the matter of fellowship? When we realise, brethren and sisters, that we've got to stand side by side, and we will do, with brethren and sisters whom we do not recognise, And they say that they are the brethren of Christ, and they all claim to be right. And there we are, we must stand amongst them all. How many divisions and sects of Christadelphia are there? Ought not to be. What is it telling us? We've got to get back, brethren and sisters, as we've been told today, to the works of our pioneer brethren, when the Father, in his grace and mercy, allowed one man to sift the truth from all the errors of Christendom for our benefit. Go back. Is Christ divided? Of course not. We seek to divide him by these matters that I've just put before you. It's wrong, brethren and sisters. I do not wish to labour these points, but to just hang on to the words of our brother and realise that many are called, few are chosen. What is our ambition? And so we come back now to Ezra, the 9th chapter and verse 13. After that all this has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great trespass, seeing that thou hast, our Elohim, hast punished us less than our iniquities deserve, and hast given us such deliverance as this. What phrase, what verse comes into mind? Thou hast not dealt with us according to our sins. And another one, it is of thy great mercies that we are not consumed. Think deeply on these matters, brethren and sisters, because that is true. And so this verse then should reflect the state of our hearts and our minds, as the word works in our hearts and our minds to drive out these sentiments of the flesh and to humble us. The more I study the word, brethren and sisters, oh, how gracious the Father has been to us to allow us. It comes home to me, Isaiah chapter 66, to this man will I look, the great Creator. What can you build for me, he says, but to this man will I look, who is of a humble and a contrite spirit, and who trembleth at my word. Let that be our attitude, brethren and sisters. Let the prayer of Ezra flood into our minds and that of Daniel, and there will be created within us, I'm sure, that right attitude towards our Heavenly Father. And so must the words of the 15th, the last verse of our chapter, come to mind. O Lord God of Israel, thou art righteous. O Yahweh Elohim of Israel, thou art righteous, for we remain yet escaped, as it is this day. Behold, we are before thee in our trespasses, for we cannot stand before thee because of this. What a prayer. What an admission, brethren and sisters. But, like Ezra, we need encouragement, do we not? Let's return then to the matter of the nail. Just let's go to Judges now, the 4th chapter and verse 18, because there we have again the nail mentioned. I leave you to reflect on some of these wonderful matters, time forbids. There it is. There was the enemy of Israel now, and it says, verse 18 of the 4th of Judges, and Jael went out to meet Sisera, said unto him, turn in, my lord, turn in, fear not. And she covered him with a blanket and so on. And as you read down that chapter, brethren and sisters, there you find that, is it verse 21, then Jael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent, and took an hammer in her hand, and went softly unto him, and smote the nail into his temples, and fastened it into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, and so he died. The enemy of Israel at that particular time. There, brethren and sisters, was an example of the handling of sin. And a great victory was won there by a woman. But the next chapter, It opens out into that beautiful song of Deborah and so on. What a beautiful prophet. Just verse 4. Lord, when thou wentest out as seer, when thou marchest out of the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped, the clouds also dropped water. What picture floods into our minds? What is before us, brethren and sisters, if we are faithful? Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 33. Deuteronomy chapter 33. There, in those opening verses there, this is the blessing of Moses. And he said, Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000 of saints, and from his right hand went a fiery law from them. What is the picture as you trace it through the scriptures? There, brethren and sisters, is the great host of the redeemed ones. Ezra will be amongst them. Will you and I? Will you and I? There they are coming up from Sinai now. And there they're coming towards Jerusalem to the marriage supper of the Lamb. Oh, what wonderful pictures unfold for us. And there it all comes out of this matter of jail now with the nail through the head there of that one who wrought evil towards Israel. Types and shadows of greater and more wonderful things to come. And so, brethren and sisters, as we reflect on these things and what is before us, there it is, Sinai, the place of judgment, the place of reward, the place of rejoicing, the marriage of the Lamb takes place, and then they come out to take that inheritance which has been promised to them. The seed of Abraham now coming with his multitudinous seed to inherit the possession of that land for the ages of the ages. And so one could go on reflecting upon these very, very wonderful matters, brethren and sisters. But we have journeyed, as we not as deeply as we might have done through these matters. But let then this wonderful example of Ezra and his circumstances come into our minds. We plead with our young people, never forget these things. Realize that we are surrounded by a Canaanite society as it was in days gone by. And let us then, yes, parents and children, let us work together, because the days are evil. The time is short. Very, very short. Perhaps shorter than we realize. And soon, that which all faithful men and women have looked for will be a reality. The Master will be in the earth again. Let us then keep these visions before our hearts and minds, that as the word worked in those of the faithful ones of the days of Ezra, it might work in us now, amongst a few of us, in the midst of a multitude, that we might, in the grace and the mercy of the Father, be found amongst that great number of the redeemed.